It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to U.S. Senator from Wisconsin, Ron Johnson, and hear why he's been holding town meetings to warn Wisconsinites about the military group ISIS.
But first, protest and civil unrest have overtaken the streets of Ferguson the last 2 weeks in the wake of the shooting of an unarmed black man by a white officer. Sources say that the last couple of days have been much calmer.
It sparked a multifaceted conversation, but our next guest, it says it was an opportunity to take an up-close look at the relationship between peace, violence, and protest.
Frank Farley joins us. He's a psychologist at Temple University and also the president-elect of the Society for the Study of Peace, Conflict, and Violence. Frank, welcome to Central Time.
I'm delighted to be with you.
Well, can you tell us a little bit about your time in Ferguson? How recently were you there?
I've been there since Wednesday, the last two and a half days, during the day and then at night. And I got back this afternoon to Philly.
And tell us about, why did you find it important to be there now?
Well, this is such a national event. Worldwide event, I discovered. One of the things that really astounded me was the international media. I spent a significant amount of time with a guy who was filming for Russian TV. Hmm. And I did an interview with Venezuelan television, Iranian television. You know, they're all over the place. So, you know, this is such an international event. And is it well representing America or is it not? Is it well representing democracy at work? What might come out of it? And so I felt that, I'm president-elect beginning in January of this, Society for the Study of Peace, Conflict, and Violence. And I thought, this is such an opportunity for me to just walk the venue and get some impressions. And so that's what I've been doing.
Well, let's hear about some of your impressions. You were there at what will be known as a historic time in our country's history. What did you see and hear?
Well, all sorts of things. Let me go through. I'd like to mention some of the positive things first, because honestly, we've been getting so much negativity out of there, and we all know that if it bleeds, it leads. And so we sometimes pass up the positive. So I want to touch on some of what I saw as sort of positive features, then we can go to the negative side of the ledger, if you will. But, this is an exercise of democratic rights, the right to demonstrate, to assemble, to protest. And, of course, there were both positive and negative features of that. It turned out that some of those rights were curtailed. The police say it was necessary. Others say it wasn't, and that there was police overreaction. And so that's one issue that will come out of this going forward. How well people were able to demonstrate and to protest and to make their views known, and what curtailment of that was undertaken, and was it legitimate? And I think that's going to lead to a debate over police and policing and civil disobedience, etc., going forward. By the way, I had a great opportunity as I was leaving the place last night at around about sometime after midnight. I ran into Sergeant Ron Johnson, who was in charge of the whole thing. He was appointed by the governor. The Missouri State Highway Patrol took over running the whole police side of things. And I bumped into him, and so I had a chance to talk with him. And his view is that, yes, there were some police problems, but in his view, he's sort of viewing it as an educational process, a sort of school, in a sense, where they can learn what was good and what was not good about the police response, and learn to do better, basically. And so he's viewing it as a educational experience, which is an interesting idea. So democratic rights being expressed in the street, we haven't seen a whole lot of examples of that of late. And so I think the report card is sort of mixed on how well that went. Raising national consciousness on race and criminal justice, I think that's a positive outcome of this. In the wake of Zimmerman, I was hoping that the whole nation would get, you know, exercised about racial disparities in such things as sentencing. I mean, when a white man and a black man commit essentially the same crime, the statistics show that the black perpetrator has roughly a 20% longer sentence as a consequence. And that's wrong. And, you know, and there are other statistics. One that I found was in the FBI Uniform Crime Reporting System, stopping people for suspicious behavior. And something like almost 49 or 50% of the stops in America are black males when they represent less than 10% of the overall population. And the Zimmerman thing was essentially a stop for quote-unquote suspicious behavior. So all of these statistics are really serious and need to be, you know, dealt with nationally. So I think that this thing in Ferguson will raise, I hope, the national consciousness on that. We didn't do a whole lot in the wake of Zimmerman. Maybe this is a 1-2 punch, and maybe this time it will raise the consciousness enough to begin to do concrete things with the criminal justice system.
Well, there certainly appears to be a greater public outcry over this incident in Missouri. And you said that although the protests have been largely free of major violence, there's been some violence, but it hasn't gone due south. But you say that that could change in an instant. What other shoe might fall?
The other shoe that everybody was telling me was if Officer Wilson does not get charged, and the grand jury allegedly won't come out with a decision until October sometime, but people were telling me that if there's no charge for this, then, as some told me, all hell will break loose. So that could be a really negative consequence if people react that way. And, you know, we don't know all of the conditions. A friend of mine, Elizabeth Loftus, was on television a day or two ago. She is the world's leading authority on eyewitness testimony. And as she was pointing out, eyewitness testimony can be notoriously unreliable. And she cited some statistics about that. So one of the things in this case is there are conflicting eyewitness reports. So hopefully the grand jury will try to winnow and sift through all of that and just see what is believable and what is not believable.
Now, one of the things that you study is peace. Were there people that you saw on the ground who were actively trying to promote peace at protests and other times?
I did. For one thing, there were a lot of interesting, you know, sort of outsiders that I would classify as offering helping behavior. There were people from the National Lawyers Guild who were wearing special green caps and were walking around as observers. There were a significant number of first aid volunteers. I was talking to one from Connecticut. First aid volunteers who were walking around to be available to help. The clergy were out in force. They were all wearing orange T-shirts that said clergy. So there was a lot of, you know, the presence of helping behavior was brought out by this event. You know, whether how it will set in the national consciousness, I don't know. Things are getting better. The drawdown of the National Guard definitely seems to have been a positive factor. And people were less fearful, in my judgment. And also protest fatigue is probably setting in. You know, you just can't keep doing it all the time. And people seem to be increasingly relaxed in walking around. The first night I was there, for example, the police would not allow you to stand still. You had to keep moving. And, you know, so people kept moving all the time, and they really couldn't stand still and talk or discuss issues. Well, the police backed off on that, and last night there were small groups of people all over the place who were talking about issues. There was one group of people who were attempting to get petitions going, and their argument was that, you know, beating the streets and chanting and shouting and so on would be less effective than signing petitions. And so they were trying to get people to sign petitions to, for example, recall the mayor of Ferguson.
Well, we'll continue this conversation. We're talking with psychologist Frank Farley. He's just returned from Ferguson, Missouri, where he was observing peace, violence, and conflict and furthering his studies there.
And we invite you to join our conversation. What would you like to know about the events unfolding in Ferguson? Have you been a part of large protest demonstrations before? And what lessons did you learn there about crowd behavior, about peace, and the way that situations unfold when large groups of people are gathered around a cause together like that? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org.
This is Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking now with psychologist Frank Farley about what's happening in Ferguson, Missouri, and what we can learn about peace, violence, and conflict.
And you can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. What questions do you have about peace, violence, and conflict? What turns a peaceful protest into a violent one? And what's the most effective way to promote social change? Are protests the way to do it? Let us know your thoughts. 800-642-1234 or talk@wpr.org. Let's start by taking a call from Rick in Milwaukee. Hi, Rick.
Hello. I've been in a couple situations like that. Probably the scariest one was, I don't know if you remember, about 10 years ago, Summerfest in the game area, it turned into a big, you know, big riot, and it was scary seeing the wave of people coming and going and bottles and rocks and things being thrown at the police. And, you know, they were cornered, they were backed up, and people were bloody, there was fights, it was unbelievable. And, you know, they were trying their best to really survive. And, you know, what are you going to do if somebody comes up? And in that situation, you know, you've got to protect yourself as the officer. You have to, and they're not seeing the big picture, and you get that mob mentality. And so I think a lot of it has to do with the media. Unfortunately, they're supposed to be neutral parties, but a lot of times they're not. And they're just, and even what I've been hearing on the radios and again on your show, I like very much, but they're not seeing the big picture of why did the officer. What really happened? Everybody's jumping the gun. He has to protect himself and the people around him. You know, until we know the whole picture, how can we judge him and judge what he did?
Thanks, Rick. What about that, Frank Farley? If we turn this on to Ferguson, you had just come back from there this week, and I'm wondering how you would compare what you saw in reality on the streets of Ferguson to what is being reported in the media.
I was struck by some of the media coverage as being, you know, as focusing on the most extreme behavior. I mean, you know, that's sort of human nature, if you will. You know, the thing that stands out against the average, everyday, humdrum backdrop is the thing that we will look at and focus on. And so the throwing of tear gas canisters and those sorts of things got the most attention. You know, some people would argue, well, that's the most newsworthy part of the whole thing. And I can see that argument. The one thing that struck me about media was one could argue that there was just too doggone much media at this thing. You know, when I'm walking around, they are all over the place and they want to interview anybody and everybody. I wouldn't have been surprised if the media were interviewing each other, you know. They were all over the place, and I mentioned earlier that from all over the world, that really struck me. You know, Russian TV, Iranian TV, different South American countries, Venezuela, for example. And boy, you know, that's going all over the world. And they and there were just interviews going on everywhere. And you know, looking for something perhaps that's newsworthy. So I think one could argue that maybe there was too much media, and it exaggerated certain things, and focused on the negative. You know, I started off this conversation tonight, you know, today, where I said I wanted to start off talking about some positive things, and but the media really has been tilting in the negative direction. Yes,
well,
may have been just too much coverage.
And we thank Rick for that call. We're going to move next to Sean joining us in Rice Lake. Hi, Sean.
Yeah, hi. I was at Occupy Minneapolis a couple of years ago. It was, you know, there was a lot of good times there with different people. Once in a while, a group or two, you know, they would have a little bit of a different opinion. But for the most part, it was, you know, there was a lot of good people that, you know, that were... We're getting together, and for anybody out there listening who wanted to get involved, for the most part, you know, it was a really good time.
All right, so Sean having a positive experience at Occupy Minneapolis. It's interesting how there were peaceful protests, many of them that happened in Ferguson, a lot of coverage of some of the rioting that happened. But what happens, Frank, in that moment that turns a protest on the edge like that, from one that's peaceful to one that's not?
We don't know precisely, but there are certain things that can happen. There are terms that we use in psychology like social facilitation or emotional contagion. So somebody, you have, and we've seen this, for example, in flash mobs as one example. So you have a large crowd. Somebody does something extreme. They knock over a light pole. Somebody else imitates that and does one themselves. Or somebody breaks a window in a shop, and then someone else does it, and you get this almost disinhibition effect going on. And again, we use terms like social facilitation, emotional contagion that can run through the group. Our impulse control sort of gets weakened, and it just boils over.
And
almost
Frank,
a snowball effect.
Frank, during the Vietnam protests, you were among a group of faculty members at the UW-Madison who patrolled the campus and tried to ensure that there was no violence overnight. I'm wondering what tactics you used to prevent violence at that time and how you used your experience from several years ago in Ferguson.
What a great question. What we did then, you know, we had like armbands. So we'd be recognized as professors who were part of the group. We had a meeting beforehand in the law school on Bascom Hill, and off we went. And we did this for several nights. It was really just to have presence there. And, you know, sometimes the mere presence of quote-unquote authority figures can calm things down. And we would talk with people who were, you know, getting really agitated, etc. And that's basically all we did. If that were to transfer over to Ferguson, I suppose the closest would be the National Lawyers Guild people who were there. And I did chat with some of them. They weren't as active as we were back in Bascom Hill in Madison. They would just go around and basically observe, you know, if they saw something that would seem to be, you know, police brutality, for example, or brutality by others than the police, etc. And I asked them, do you do anything about it? And they said, no, we just sort of observe it. And then I think they relay that information back to their national organization for whatever use. It was pretty low key, but I think by having, you know, enough of them around, it might have helped. I think having the clergy around. The clergy were omnipresent. They really were You know, if a confrontation between police and citizens took place, often the clergy would go there immediately. So they were behaving more like we professors at UW-Madison behaved, you know, back in the Vietnam era.
And we leave it there. Frank, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your experience.
You're welcome.
That was Frank Farley, a psychologist at Temple University and president-elect of the Society for the Study of Peace, Conflict, and Violence. He just came back from Ferguson, Missouri.
I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Rob Ferret, on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we celebrate the Wisconsin tradition of the Door County Fish Boil, and we ask a master boiler how to have one at home.
First, it has been 2 weeks since the United States began airstrikes against the Islamic militant group ISIS in Iraq, and news about the group has continued to make headlines throughout the week.
A YouTube video emerged Tuesday of a member of ISIS beheading American journalist James Foley, and President Obama responded, saying the U.S. will be vigilant and relentless and will do what it must to protect its people.
Yesterday, Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel said the group is beyond just a terrorist group, calling it as sophisticated and well-funded as any group that we have seen.
U.S. Senator Ron Johnson also joined the national conversation. He has been holding town hall meetings around the state this week to warn Wisconsinites about what he calls a gathering storm to strike America.
Senator Johnson is a member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and he joins us now to talk about possible threats posed by ISIS. Senator Johnson, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, Veronica, hello, Cynthia. How are you doing?
Doing well. Glad you could be here. Now, you've been holding town hall meetings this week to warn Americans about ISIS. Now, we're a country who's lived through September 11th, through orange threats, red threats, shoe bombers. Why do we need to be on high alert all over again?
Well, to be accurate, I hold my town hall meetings primarily talking about the dangers of our fiscal mismanagement, the record deficits and accumulating debt. But, you know, Wisconsinites are very concerned about what's happening throughout the world, not only just in Iraq, but Syria and Ukraine, and certainly between Israel and Hamas. But we've been getting an awful lot of questions, and I have been, because I've been on the Foreign Relations Committee. We've held hearings on exactly what's been happening, not only in Syria, but now as we're seeing ISIS spill out of Syria into Iraq. We're really witnessing, to a certain extent, the disintegration of the state of Iraq, and this is a gathering storm. ISIS, as the Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel said, these are evil people. They are barbarians. They cannot be contained. They're very well disciplined. They're very strategic. They've been very patient setting up this caliphate. And they've been very clear in terms of what their long-term aims are. And it really is to utilize that caliphate, that state, as a base of operations against the West. I have no idea why they want to destroy Western culture, but that is exactly what they want to do. They were so extreme, ISIS, that they were actually kicked out of Al-Qaeda. So this is not a group that can be contained. It's a group that needs to be defeated.
This week we've been seeing stories about the number of Westerners, Americans, and British nationals who may be part of ISIS. What kinds of specific threats do you see ISIS posing to the United States right now?
Well, we had Deputy Assistant Secretary of State Brett McGurk in front of our Foreign Relations Committee on July 24th, and I asked him the specific question, what threat does ISIS represent to America? And this is basically what he described it. He said, ISIS is funneling 30 to 50 suicide bombers into Iraq per month. And what ISIS is also doing is they're recruiting jihadists from around the world. But we've already got, I think, intelligence communities have documented hundreds of jihadists into Syria with Western passports. And so the point that Mr. McGurk made was that it'd be easy for ISIS to start funneling those suicide bombers into Western countries. And actually, the week he testified, there were two Western suicide bombers, one from Australia, one from Germany, that set themselves off in Baghdad. And of course, we've already witnessed the first American-bred suicide bomber, fellow from Florida, actually trained in Syria, went back to Florida, but came back and blew himself up in Syria in May. So that is exactly one of the things we have to worry about, is the jihadists bringing the battle to the West, to America.
And at these town hall meetings where you're talking about these threats, how do people respond?
Well, they're highly concerned, and they need to be concerned. And I've just been describing the situation as it's been relayed to us through testimony in the Foreign Relations Department. And you know, we're witnessing, because of our debt and deficit, remember former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Mike Mullen, said that the greatest threat to our national security is our debt and deficit. It makes us economically weak. And if we're economically weak, we can't be militarily strong either. And so, you know, we're witnessing enormous pressure on our budgets, including our defense budget. This is no time to be hollowing our military. We have to be very strategic in how we structure our forces. We have to recognize the asymmetric threat that terrorism represents to America. And we need to be smart about this. And we have to, the first thing we have to do is not deny reality. We have to recognize the danger. And I am concerned. You know, President Obama, when ISIS took over Fallujah back in January, his comment was, oh, you know, they're the JV team. Just because they're putting on a Lakers uniform doesn't make them Kobe Bryant. That is really giving, you know, not paying the type of attention, not giving the serious consideration to the threat that ISIS represents. And, you know, it's unfortunate that it took the videotaping of the beheading of an American journalist, Jim Foley, to, I guess, grab President Obama's attention enough to actually make a statement. I appreciate the fact that he's taken some action when he had to prevent the genocide of the Yazidis and help the Kurds, the Peshmerga, take back the Mosul Dam.
Well, let's talk about
that's just the minimum action that has to be taken.
I want to talk about those airstrikes because right now those airstrikes are helping to retake some of northern Iraq. But should the situation deteriorate, given the seriousness of the situation that you just described with ISIS, would you support U.S. military intervention on the ground?
Well, of course, what we should have done is exactly what we did after World War II. And after the Korean War, leave stabilizing forces behind in Iraq, and we didn't do that. When we left Iraq, we left our ability to influence the coalition government, and this never should have happened, but it's happening. We defeated Al Qaeda in Iraq once when we had 168,000 troops during that surge. When Al Qaeda in Iraq was about 68,000 troops, now ISIS is 15,000 to 17,000 troops. They're better resourced, they're better trained, they're far more effective. And so what I think President Obama needs to do is he needs to get off the golf course, get on the phone, and he needs to start assembling that coalition of a willing of Western nations as well as Arab states that are threatened directly by this gathering storm that is ISIS. And we need to assemble that coalition of the willing, and we have to have as our primary objective their defeat.
And I want to press you a little bit on that, though. Given the seriousness of the threat that you're describing and perhaps attacks on American soil, would you support troops on the ground if the situation continues to deteriorate?
As part of a coalition effort, I think that's what we're going to have to anticipate. And I think Defense Secretary Hagel is saying as much just yesterday in his statements. I think this administration has finally come to the realization that it was a huge mistake not to leave a stabilizing force to allow ISIS to reform from Al-Qaeda in Iraq, and they have to be dealt with. They can't be contained. They have to be defeated. But again, we'll try and do it by providing resources and backup to the Kurdish Peshmerga, certainly to the Iraqi forces. But again, as was told to us in testimony, ISIS is more than double the size of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And remember, we had 168,000 American troops it took to defeat Al-Qaeda in Iraq back in 2007. So this isn't going to be some little pinprick measure. You know, air power alone is not going to defeat ISIS. And I think people are coming to the conclusion that it cannot be contained. It's going to have to be defeated. Again, I can't tell you exactly how we're going to be doing it, but we should be doing what President Obama should be doing, what President Bush did, is assemble a coalition of the willing, get the UN behind this, and recognize that the danger that ISIS represents to the entire free world.
Now, what you're saying is provocative. Right now, we're hearing that there is no one out there from the United States who has the appetite to have more on-the-ground involvement in Iraq. But you're saying with the coalition of the willing, you think it is the place of the United States to join that coalition on the ground to eradicate ISIS.
Well, we can sit back and we can wait for terrorists to strike here in America. Is that what we really want to do? I really don't. You remember, we denied We buried our head in the sands in the 90s when Al-Qaeda declared war on us, and we didn't take out Osama bin Laden when we had the opportunity to. And we allowed the threat of Al-Qaeda to gather and finally strike America and slaughtered a couple thousand Americans when the Twin Towers came down. I mean, is it going to take another terrorist attack in America? And by the way, I would consider the beheading of an American journalist a terrorist attack on this nation.
And so given that terrorist attack on the nation that you're talking about, the situation, the possibility of strikes against America on homeland soil, are you advocating for action now? Is it possible that if we wait too late, that the chance will be lost to contain the damage?
Yes, we've already waited too late. We never should have left Iraq. We should have left a stabilizing force behind, and we are paying the consequences of that because of that strategic, historic blunder. And so let's not make another strategic, historic blunder by continuing to ignore this threat. I mean, the fact of the matter is America is already engaged in Iraq. We are bombing. We are at war with ISIS. You know, and if we don't recognize that fact, I mean, again, we're just denying reality. We already have close to 1,000 troops in Iraq right now. You know, they may not be engaged specifically firing rifles at ISIS, but my guess is they're certainly gathering intelligence. My guess is they're certainly helping to spot and direct targeting the attacks from our bombers. So we are engaged. I don't know. I'm not a military expert. I don't know to what extent we're going to have to engage. All I'm saying is our goal should be clearly articulated, and our goal should be the defeat of ISIS because they cannot be contained.
There is no plan on the table right now to eradicate ISIS, as I understand it. There is simply the airstrikes planned. Given that, what is your priority number one, do you think, for dealing with ISIS when you get back to Washington?
Well, the first thing we have to do is we have to make sure whatever part of Iraq is stabilized, we do everything we can to keep it stabilized. In other words, and I've been advocating this for really a couple of months, is we need to resource the Peshmerga, the Kurdish troops. We have to make sure that they are armed, they have adequate resources to stabilize and protect the Kurdish region. We better make sure that Jordan remains a sovereign nation, that ISIS doesn't start looking at Jordan and start destabilizing that, and we need to certainly protect all of our Americans in that region, including in Baghdad. So that's the first step. But the next step, again, is to have President Obama begin to assemble that coalition of the willing, and then, you know, exactly what the strategy will be, exactly what the force structure, whether it's going to be NATO type of structure. I believe our goal has to be the defeat of ISIS.
Senator Johnson, thank you so much for joining us.
Have a great day.
We've been speaking with U.S. Senator Ron Johnson about the militant group ISIS. He's been holding town hall meetings around the state this week to warn Wisconsinites about the possible threat from the group. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. Anyone who's experienced a fish boil will likely never forget the experience. The spectacle of leaping flames around a huge cauldron of boiling water is a longtime tradition in Door County.
And while Door County is the birthplace of the fish boil, we'll learn how to make one at home, minus the flames. With us now is Dan Peterson from the Viking Grill in Ellison Bay, Door County. He's been a master boiler for 50 years. Dan, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you.
So, Dan, where did this tradition of the Door County fish boil come from?
Well, that's very hard to say, but you have to imagine that the loggers were here first, and they had a lot of fish, and they had the boats and everything. So it was what they did, I guess, just went out and caught some fish, and they had a big pot, and there's a lot of people working. It's a meal served to a lot of people in a short time, and it's just delicious. But I believe it was probably in 1800s is when it started.
And, of course, now we can see it all over the country, as far afield as Pennsylvania. Why don't you describe it for us and why, you know, it's got such a wide appeal?
Well, it's a Door County tradition as you see it right now, and it started here at the Viking in about 1960-61. Lawrence Annette Wickman started just to raise their business a little bit. Before that, it was done in church areas and for groups like that anyway. But it's to do it in our situation here, we have a cauldron and we have about 20 gallons of water and big baskets and everything like that. But it's not necessary to boil it. You can use your big chili pot at home. Take your little colander and put some potatoes and some onions and some fish in it. And it's all timed, cooking time. It takes about 24 minutes for the whole process. It takes a lot of salt. It kind of scares people, the amount of salt. And you certainly don't want to do a boil over on your stove, not before you call your fire department, at least. So, but it is a great meal. It's served with butter over it, and along with the lemons and cherry pie for dessert. It is a meal that people will remember, without a doubt.
Now, part of what's so memorable is the preparation, is this incredible tower of flames that comes when the fish start boiling in that water. Now, that's not really something you want to be trying at home, but is there a way to replicate that experience?
Well, what it is during the cooking process, there's oil in the fish. And oil being lighter than water, it settles on the top. With the washing of the sweet red potatoes and the onions, it turns into a gray or brown matter. So what we do is we intensify the boil by throwing fuel oil on the fire. On the fire, I repeat that, not in the pot. And it enhances the boil so great it just froths over. It lasts about 4 or 5 seconds. And while it's frothing over, we take the food out. So, but you don't want to do that at home.
It sounds like if you take one wrong move, it could be a disaster. Have you had any close calls yourself?
Well, yes, the wind has changed a couple different times, and that's tough. But you have to remember, use fuel oil. Now, somebody will come by and say, well, how much gas do you use? You're going to use gas once, and that's a big mistake. So, but it is an awesome, good meal. Really
is there a fish boil season? Is it better done in fall, given the nature of the flames?
Actually, the best time of the year is probably when the fish comes out of the cold winter water. But we do the fish boil here. We open in April, and I do a fish boil every Friday till the end of December. And during the summer, we do it 3, 4, 5 days a week, depending on the demand.
Now, take us through a bit of the recipe step by step. I noticed that the timing of when to add each ingredient is quite exact. Why is that?
Well, because of the cooking time. Now, when we start, I'll do it with our cauldron here, with 20 gallons of water. The first thing we put in is about 3 pounds of salt. We bring that water to a boil, and the next thing that goes in is about 25 pounds of potatoes and another pound of salt. We'll cook those potatoes about 8-10 minutes, and then we put our onions in. They're sweet, small onions, and we cook those about 8 minutes. And then it's time for the fish to go in. Now, all this cooking time is boil time. It's not just in the water. It's boil time. And we put the fish in, and we'll cook those 8 to 10 minutes, depending on the size and things like that. And then at the very end, I have our tradition. We ring the bell 1 minute before we're going to boil it over so people can get their Kodak moment or whatever it is. And big flame comes up. And it's kind of scary, but it's very much in control here.
Now, I've heard people say that the thing about the fish boil is the drama of it, that tower of flame. Can you make the case that the food is actually delicious, that throwing stuff into boiling water actually produces tasty food?
Well, you know, a lot of people boil things and they think it's real good when they're boiling it in grease in a French fryer. Now, you take boiling it in water, you make your choice. What would you rather have?
Mm-hmm. Well, one is healthier.
Well, it certainly is, and it is so good. Prepared properly, it's just a magnificent meal.
And then I guess you've got all that melted butter on top.
Well, yeah, that's maybe cheating a little bit, but it's Wisconsin butter, so that's all right.
So if I did my math correctly, the fish itself only boils for about 10 minutes.
That's correct.
And that's enough?
That is enough. You could... In a cooking process, you can tell with our big cauldrons we have, you can see about 4 or 5 minutes into the cooking, the fish will start to float just a little bit. And it's one of the indicators of that your boil's coming along good and the fish is cooking just right. So,
Now, you've been doing this for 50 years. That's a long time. Does it ever get old, or is it something that's always fresh and exciting?
Actually, probably longer than that, but my brother and I were like 9 or 10 years old when we first started helping my father over in Bailey's Harbor. It was just a thing that we did once in a while. It was called a trout boil back then. And we were left outside to keep the fire going. It was done in a big wash tub with some wire crimped together. Nowadays, everything is stainless steel, and it much, much safer and healthier, I would say. But, it's quite a treat.
And what would you say to someone who's trying to think about how to do this at home in just our last 30 seconds here?
Well, you just use your chili pot, like I said. Fill it with water. Take your little colander and put your potatoes in. It's a serving for 8, about 16 chunks of fish, small onions, 16 potatoes, and a lot of salt, though. You start with a quarter pound and then another little quarter pound and another quarter pound on each time, and don't boil it over.
And I've got a little taste of Door County. Thank you so much, Dan.
Thank you.
That was Dan Peterson, master fish boiler from the Viking Grill in Ellison Bay, Door County. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.